And welcome back. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. About 1 in 10 Americans struggle with dyslexia, a learning disability that can make reading a challenge. Children with dyslexia are often stigmatized and feel the sting of failure as they struggle with their disability. And that struggle can last for years. By the time a student is diagnosed with dyslexia, frequently in second or third grade, they've already experienced numerous failures in school.
Well, they put me at a table with three, and they called it the dummy class. And we faced the back of the teacher, who addressed the rest of the class. The frustration of that made me just give up. I was ostracized.
That's Phil Schultz talking to NPR a few years ago about his experience growing up with dyslexia. And while he may have felt ostracized as a young boy, Schultz went on to win the Pulitzer Prize in poetry. But today, too many students still feel that sting, as Massachusetts sixth grader Josh Tebow explains.
There was a student that came up and said, "Are you stupid?" Because my brain was working in a different way, and I'm just like, "No, I am not stupid. I am just dyslexic."
Josh is taking part in cutting-edge research that could change the way parents, educators, and scientists think about dyslexia. The studies are showing that it may be possible to detect signs of the disability in children's brains well before they start learning to read, and therefore well before they experience that failure in school.
The research by MIT and Children's Hospital is the focus in this. Is the focus of the second in our new weekly WBUR series called Brain Matters, Reporting from the Front Lines of Neuroscience. WBUR's Rachel Zimmerman explored these new insights into how learning disabilities manifest themselves in the brain. And in a few minutes, we'll talk with one of those researchers from MIT. But first, let's listen to an excerpt from Rachel's story this morning.
The researchers are finding that scanning the brains of kindergartners can help improve predictions of how the children will master reading later on. Using cutting-edge MRI technology, the scientists are able to pinpoint a specific neural pathway, a white matter tract in the brain, that appears to be related to dyslexia. It's called the arcuate fasciculus. Elizabeth Norton, a neuroscientist at MIT's McGovern Institute for Brain Research, explains.
It's an arch-shaped bundle of fibers that connects the frontal language areas of the brain to the areas in the temporal lobe that are important for language.
Norton says we're not quite ready to simply take a picture of your child's brain and say, aha, this kid is going to have dyslexia. But we're getting closer to that point.
We see that in children who in kindergarten already have strong pre-reading scores, their arcuate fasciculus is both bigger and more well-organized. So we can see a child with a score of 0 has a very small and not particularly well-organized arcuate fasciculus.
Stories out loud to me, carefully and as quickly and as well as you can. Okay?
Archive minds. No, I don't know that word.
Megan Estrada enrolled her son Tomas, now 8 years old, in the MIT study after seeing that he was having difficulty.
Cat Mimi.
When he was in kindergarten, you know, he was having some serious trouble. Took him about a year to learn the word the. I could see that he needed more help.
MIT neuroscientist John Gabrielli is one of the lead investigators of the study Tomas is in. The children wear colorful electrode caps to measure electrical activity in their brains. They also take cognitive tests and get MRIs to examine the structure and function of their brains. The plan is to follow all 186 kids through the second grade.
The challenge for us now soon will be to figure out what kind of interventions can be done in a 4-year-old or a 3-year-old that might put her or him on a different pathway altogether. You know, can we have a child arrive at school who'll be ready to read and not wait for failure at all, but have intervened so early that the child never experiences that failure at all?
That's MIT's John Gabrielli speaking in a report from WBUR's Rachel Zimmerman. Gabrielli is a professor of health sciences and technology and cognitive neuroscience at MIT, and he joins us now in the studio. Professor, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Also with us in the studio is Janet Tebow. Her son Josh, who we heard a clip of at the top of this segment, is participating in the research at MIT and at Children's Hospital. Janet, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we know this may be a challenge that a lot of you know quite a great deal about if you've personally dealt with dyslexia or you have a family member who struggles with dyslexia. What are your questions for Professor Gabrielli or for Janet Tebow, who's also got four children, right?
Four children who have dyslexia.
With dyslexia. And what are your questions about the frontiers of this research that may show that brains of children, even before they start learning or start learning how to read, are showing signs of different patterns? What does that mean for you? And what does that mean for the future of the best ways to deal with helping children with dyslexia? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Well, Janet, I wonder if we could just start with you, spend a couple minutes, and just describe to us, first of all, I mean, you said you had four children who have
Four out of five.
Who have dyslexia. And what is it like for them? What are the kind of challenges they face on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I think the first thing when I look back at each of them in kindergarten, they had a really hard time understanding the connection between letters that they saw in pages, the sounds that those letters made, and then the way to put all those letters together. So each one of them in kindergarten, they had a letter of the week. And every week they were supposed to go home for that letter and find pictures or words that started with that letter. And that basic fact of, you know, this week it's B, I'm going to find box, bag, boy, was so foreign to them and so hard. It was, you know, words that had B in it, but not at the start of the letter, or just words that were random and had nothing to do with B. That connection just wasn't made for them, and it was a struggle. And when they got older and tried to start reading, the best way I could describe it was you could see the words sort of go off the page into their eyes and into their brain, and they would just knock around in the brain randomly and never come out in any sort of real order. So that act of making sense of it all was just really hard for them.
And when your first child received the diagnosis, even before that, was there a point in time where you thought, you know, is it maybe just a developmental stage that my child's in, or, you know, maybe they're just behind for this year and we'll catch up? I mean, how did you know or have a feeling that maybe it was something neurological and not just developmental?
We had signs in preschool that letters and sounds were hard for him. My husband and I are both voracious readers, so we never thought that any of our children would have any struggle with reading. And in second grade, it really was clear that he was struggling. He, you know, couldn't keep up with other kids. He didn't understand homework. He just wasn't making any real progress. And so the school initially suggested that he get tested. And through that, we were able to identify where his weaknesses were. But we needed to go outside of the school to have a neuropsychologist evaluate him to get the real diagnosis to indicate that it was dyslexia. And then that started to make sense because all of these struggles now had a word associated with them. And we felt like we were on a path to try and figure out a solution. And so the diagnosis wasn't scary. It just helped us figure out where we needed to go next.
Right. But the key thing is that up until recently, your children had to go through all those years of struggle.
Sure.
Right? And so that's what I'm wondering. I really appreciate your perspective on this, because the hope is as the research goes forward, children won't have to wait that long before getting a diagnosis. What difference would that have made your kids?
I can give you some examples of how they struggle, because I think you can form a picture of what it looks like to have a hard time reading. But it's not just the reading class. It's the math class where there are word problems that everybody else can read in second grade. And even if you're great at math, computation, you don't understand the words on the page, so you can't do math. And you get into science and social studies, and there are little snippets to read, and you can't do that, so you can't participate in those classes. And that's all frustrating. You're not doing the work. You're not successful. Every time it's read aloud time, everybody in the room groans, and you're smart, and you pick up on that. So that's horrible. You know, if you don't finish your work, sometimes you're kept in at recess so that you can finish your work, so you don't get the time to play with your friends. You go to library and you can't go over to where the books are that everybody else is reading because the librarian knows you can't read them, so she sends you someplace else, trying to be helpful, but it's just one more part of your day where you're not like everybody else. You have book buddies in second grade where you're supposed to be reading to them, and they're reading to you because you're not able to participate on that. So sort of at every point in your school day, if you're really one of those struggling readers, it's hard. It's alienating. It's you're not like everybody else.
Right. And so hopefully in the future, if kids get diagnosed earlier, they won't basically have that constant struggle, that anchor prohibiting their progress.
Sure. And, you know, and when you look at a child with dyslexia, you can focus in on the things that they can't do, but there are so many amazing gifts that these students can do. They're creative thinkers. They think outside the box. They're very perceptive. They're very quick. They're very witty. And they have amazing other strengths. And it's a shame to think how much time is focused on the things that they can't do and having them experience that much failure, often at the expense of the things that they can do.
Right. Well, that's Janet Thibault. Her son, Josh, is a sixth grader participating in research that's going on at MIT and Children's Hospital that are giving researchers new insights into how early differences in the structure of the brain show up between children who have dyslexia and those who do not. So, Professor Gabrielli, let's bring you into the conversation here. Can you just describe to us what these structural differences in the brain are that you're seeing in the imagery from your research?
Yeah. So we use a method called diffusion tensor imaging. And what it does is it uses a movement that happens all the time of water in our brain to help us identify the white matter pathways in the brain. These are the superhighways of information conduction across the brain that tie together different parts of our brain and make them into efficient networks to accomplish big things like reading. Mm-hmm. And so we can just have the amazing thing about these imaging methods is you can ask a child who's 4 or 5 to lie in a scanner if they're willing to lie still and take this picture of their brain and then analyze it and relate it to how they're doing and various kinds of pre-reading skills. And so we're able to see in these children, on average, that the children who are lagging behind in pre-reading skills, which is an indicator that reading might be difficult, have these brain differences even before they ever get explicit instruction in school.
So has your research basically shown that the or upended what was a or answered what was a long-standing question, which was the dyslexia causing the differences in the brain, or were the brain differences precursors to the dyslexia?
Yeah, because most of the research before looking at the brains of children and adults with dyslexia looked at them when they're already reading, having experience in reading failure. That's how they get into the study, because they're identified as dyslexic. And so we didn't know how much of this was a difference in the brain compensating, doing their best they can, or how much of it is already a risk right from the start before a teacher ever opens a book to teach them to read. And work from our lab and Nadine Gebb's lab at Children's Hospital has made it really clear that this brain difference is present even before reading instruction begins.
Can we say with any sort of confidence that those brain differences are the thing that's causing the dyslexia?
At two levels, we can't quite. Mm. And so, as a scientist, we want to be careful.
Right.
So one is we don't know what the root cause is. We don't know what the thing is that leads to that brain difference, the genetics, the experience at home, and so on. We just don't know that yet. So we're far from saying that. And also, reading is such a complex skill involving vision, language, attention, that there might be several different factors that contribute to an individual child's pattern of difficulty.
Right, because I'm seeing here from some reporting regarding results from your research that came out last year that you did see a correlation between the size and organization of that portion of the brain, the arcuate fasciculus.
Yes.
And a correlation between the size of that part of the brain and a child's ability to identify and manipulate language sounds. So
yes.
A key skill in sort of pre-literacy.
Yes.
But you didn't find a correlation between other reading skills tested, including the ability to, say, name familiar objects or as rapidly as a child could, or the ability to name letters.
Exactly. So we find this relationship between this one brain structure in pre-reading kindergartners and one specific ability that's important to learn to read, but other abilities that come into reading, as far as we can measure them, likely have other brain bases.
Mm. So what do you hope that that your research is going to help with moving forward as we better understand, you know, both the causes and outcomes of these different brain differences in brain structure?
So at one level, we just want to understand more deeply what is the brain difference, because we think that will be a key to improving identification and intervention. At another level, a practical thought is that the more we could identify a child very early in this process, before they have the reading failure, that we could do something that would really diminish the risk of that failure.
Right. And I'm curious, some of these young people who have been in your study have been with you for some time, right?
Yeah, we're seeing now the returning kindergartners in first and second grade.
First and second grade. So just a couple of years, or maybe not that long. Because what I was going to ask you is if they'd been with you for some time and they are receiving a form of early intervention, are you seeing the brain imagery of their brains catching up with where they're supposed to be over time?
Yeah, some individual children are getting intervention, but others are not.
Right.
But there are studies that show beautifully how the brain can be responsive to effective intervention and changes in both structure and function that go with effective intervention. So the brain is plastic, and that's, you know, we're counting on that plasticity as a source of support for children who struggle to read.
There seems to be a lot of evidence that early intervention helps with a lot of neurological challenges that children face. I hear like autism, the earlier that it can be identified, the better, the more effective the early intervention is. So more about brain plasticity in children there. But let's take a couple calls here. Listeners, we're talking about the frontiers of neuroscience and specifically how researchers are saying that early diagnosis of dyslexia may be possible with brain imaging. And we're at the cutting edge of that research here with Professor John Gabrielli and Janet Tebow, who's the mother of Josh Tebow, a sixth grader involved in this research. So let's take a call here. Mia is calling from Waltham. You're on the air, Mia.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. This is a really interesting topic for me. My husband has a mild case of, or I don't know if you say case, but of dyslexia, has his entire life, and we now have a nine-month-old son. So as I was listening to this program, I was thinking, I wonder if there's any evidence for whether dyslexia is hereditary, and certainly it's probably too soon for us to identify any signs in our son, but I am curious about the hereditary indicators and things that we could start to look out for.
Is that your son that we hear in the background?
He is. We're actually in the car. I literally pulled over into a parking lot to be safe, and he's saying, "Why aren't you driving?"
Good. Well, I'm glad.
Very verbal.
I'm glad he's a public radio listener at such a young age. So, Mia, thank you for your call. I want to get both your perspectives on this, John and Janet. But John, let me start with you. Hereditary aspects to dyslexia.
So we know that. To a certain extent, dyslexia tends to run in families. It's what people call moderately heritable. That is, it doesn't mean if you have a parent or a sibling that you will have it at all. It's very far from that. But it does significantly increase the risk. So, you know, one would say that if there's a family member, it's good to keep an extra eye out on a child's progress.
Mm. And Janet, I mean, four of your five children have it.
Yes, and we noticed as soon as we started getting our children diagnosed and we learned more about it that we could go back and make those connections to other family members who presented with similar issues, never received service because they were older than any services were available. But yes, we've definitely noticed that it's good to watch out. We were much more aware with our younger children than we were with Chris. Chris seemed like a you know, perfectly typically developing child. He loved stories. He would talk in paragraphs. It wasn't until he got to school where it started to become reading-based and writing-based where that love of books and that love of words changed.
Well, I'm curious, as a mother who's been through this, what advice you'd give to someone like Mia, whose son is just 9 months old now?
I would treasure your nine-month-old child, and I would read to them as much as possible, and I would make growing up fun. I would certainly be sensitive if when your child in kindergarten or preschool comes home and can't stand that letter of the day exercise and can't make sense with some of those activities around literacy and around words and letters and sounds, to be on the lookout for it and be honest with your school district, because there are some schools that are willing to do earlier testing. There are some schools that aren't, but you have a history trait now, and you want to be watchful of that.
Well, let's take another call that dovetails to that point beautifully. Amy is calling from Somerville. You're on the air, Amy.
Hi. I have an interesting story in that I'm dyslexic myself. I also teach Orton-Gillingham, which is what is recommended for lots of kids with dyslexia. And I also work in a school district where people are wanting their kids to learn to read really early, what I see as too early. So I'm really confused as all this new research comes out, because I absolutely believe in early detection and early intervention. That's what happened for my son, who's also dyslexic. But I also fear that there's going to be a bunch of parents out there who are going to run out and, you know, hear this research and think that they can start things even early. Even like you have callers who just called with nine-month-old babies. Like, can we start stuff really early? And so I'm afraid of that, even though I know that the research is so important. And when you really do have dyslexia, as early as possible is important, but I worry about what it's going to do to, you know, to the mainstream.
Right.
I just would love to hear what your speakers have to say about that.
Amy, thank you so much for your call. Before we actually get a thought from our guests, I want to take another call on this point. Chris is calling from Jamaica Plain. You're on the air, Chris.
Hi, yes, I'm a second grade teacher, and I would echo what the last caller said about the importance of early detection. I think it's, you know, and I would say kindergarten, we already have the tools out to do that. And the key is that the kids know when they're struggling. Kids who have learning challenges know it. And often the parents actually, and sometimes other educators, diminish that. And kids really suffer, and that's what I've seen at the different points as a second grade teacher, is kids who are so smart and who love school, now they're just struggling, and people, they know they're having a problem. So what helps, to me, what's so powerful is when the adults in their lives acknowledge that and say, we've got a plan.
So Chris, if I may ask, does that mean that you don't necessarily see a place for these new brain scans to be maybe done on more young children? I'm not quite sure where you're headed with this.
Well, I think earlier, there's such thing as too early as the last caller said. I think kindergarten is a good point. Maybe I think we already have some tests that pop, you can really see kids who have phonemic awareness issues. I know that I'm not a specialist in that area, and I know I actually struck as a first grader, I had difficulty learning to read this way, and I was in the nurse's office all the time.
Right.
It came together for me in second grade. I wasn't dyslexic.
Well, Chris, if forgive me, but let me take it back from you there, because I want to leave enough time for our guest to respond to both your and Amy's point. So thanks so much for your call. John Gabrielli, let me just first turn to you. We hear two voices there from people who are concerned about the possible downsides of earlier diagnosis of dyslexia. Your response to that?
So I think the important thing is that as we develop, whether it's brain imaging or school testing or whatever, better ways of identifying individuals who are at high risk for reading failure, we have to be very careful how accurate those are. So we wouldn't advocate having some massive testing program beyond the measures, but their measures are getting better and better. And the whole goal of the research is to get more so accurate that it's really meaningful to examine this. So we now have infants get hearing tests when they're born regularly. We certainly wouldn't push early reading, but the reading skills, the phonemic awareness, the ability to name things quickly, we can measure those very gently and quickly in a way that's not discouraging for a child.
Right. I presume so that the greater the accuracy of the test, the less the worry that Amy might have of overdiagnosis. But what about what she said about introducing that stigma if you know what your diagnosis is at such a young age?
So I think this is a brave new world we're moving into a little bit, which is that there is a trade-off that I respect in that call, which is the more we understand early risk factors and want to help people, the more diagnostic and labels that lead to stigma are a risk. And I think that's a big issue for, you know, thinking ethically and socially about how to manage this humanely.
Now, you've wanted to work with schools to sort of aid both them and your research. And many schools have said we can't participate, not because as educators we don't want to, but that if an earlier diagnosis does show up, then they're obliged to do something to help the children, but perhaps they can't afford it.
Yeah, so let me say, I'm especially impressed by the schools that did collaborate with us, who really see reading as such an important thing that they opened their doors to us and let us communicate with their parents in an incredibly good way. But schools are very pressured in terms of resources and responsibilities. And I think we have to give them the tools to meet that pressure. And we're still at a research phase. So I respect that a school may say, you know, come back to us when you have this, when it's ready from prime time, right, not when it just gives information to parents that could be misleading or troublesome.
Well, John Gabrielli is a professor of health sciences and technology and cognitive neuroscience at MIT. He's helping lead this research into early diagnosis of dyslexia. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Janet Tebow, her son Josh, is participating in this new research. Janet, it was a pleasure to speak with you, and I really appreciate your perspective.
Thanks.
Thank you so
me.
Much. And listeners, you can find a link to Rachel Zimmerman's story about the frontiers of neuroscience regarding dyslexia at our website, radioboston.org. There's more in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.